and welcome to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich. Having a little bit of difficulty with my sound, and hopefully we'll be able to fix that in 1 second and get that taken care of. Yeah, we're on today on RVN Live. We'll be talking for the next 2 hours on the issue of HARP, and hopefully we'll be able to get into this issue and be able to explore it a little bit. For those that have tuned in for the first time, this is Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich. We've been having a little bit of difficulty this morning with the lines, and hopefully we'll get that squared away, and we'll be able to carry on with the show this morning and have a smooth program. I hear music coming up in the background, and I'm not sure whether that's supposed to come up right now, but we'll let it come up and go for just a short break here, and maybe Kelly and I can square this away. And welcome to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich. I apologize for that problem we had at the front end of the program this morning, a little communication difficulties, but I think we've got them squared away, at least for now. We're on RBM Live, and today's topic is the HARP issue, and that's been an issue that has been near and dear to my heart for the last 12 years that we've been reporting on this matter. And, you know, we're going to talk a little bit about the background and how Gene Manning and I came together to write the book Angels Don't Play This HARP. It was the first major expose on this issue, and one that brought it into the mainstream discussion, at least over the last few years, starting to get a little bit more visibility. So we'll talk a little bit about HARP. We'll open the lines to callers at any time during the next couple of hours to kind of explore this subject. But HARP is the High-Frequency Active Auroral Research Project based here in Alaska. And originally, this was a project run by the Air Force and Navy, eventually turned over to DARPA to actually manage and run. But this facility was a large, and is, in fact, a very large radio frequency broadcasting facility. It has, right now, 180 antenna in the field of antenna that has been constructed about 250 miles northeast of where I am right now in Anchorage, Alaska. And what this was set up to do was essentially to test a bunch of ideas, a number of ideas that the military was kicking around, and at the same time, enhanced knowledge of an area that's really involved a lot with our communication systems and quality of our communications. Maybe that's part of our problem today. Who knows? The ionosphere is a layer that begins about 30 miles above the Earth's surface and extends several hundred miles out. And it's an energized area. In fact, when solar radiation comes in from the sun, many of the particle streams and energy streams are sort of filtered out by this layer. And what happens then is, the ionosphere, when the sun has got, like, for instance, very high solar activity, it affects the ionosphere, interferes with communication, and so we get problems with not just radio and television communication, wireless kinds of communication, but we also can get interference with even ground lines. Even power grids can be interfered with in extreme situations. You know, when the solar activity is real high is also where we see what are referred to as the northern lights, and often these will move down into the even the southern regions of the United States and around the world when solar activity, again, is very high. We have the opposite or the same effect at the southern polar regions, and the same is true. When there's high solar activity, we get lots of the northern lights here in the northern hemisphere. And what this is actually energy interacting with oxygen and nitrogen up in the atmosphere, creating those incredible visual effects. But what we also know is that when you manipulate factors that could affect the ionosphere, you can change the character of communications. This is where HARP really began. When it started, it was really to look at, you know, can we enhance our own communication system during these particular periods, and can we maybe interfere with our adversaries' communications? And so that's where it begins. There was a gentleman by the name of Dr. Bernard Eastland, who is an inventor, brilliant physicist, well-known for over 50 professional peer-reviewed papers that he's put out over the years. He started his career back during the Atomic Energy Commission days back in the 50s. And what he did is came up with a number of ideas that would manipulate the ionosphere for specific weapons uses and applications, as well as some other pretty interesting applications. Maybe we can get into those uses as we go through the program today. But what Dr. Eastland was looking at was the North Slope of Alaska, and in his particular idea, you needed a large array or field of antennas, and then you also needed huge amounts of raw energy, some way to create electrical energy at very large quantities. And the idea was to take natural gas from the North Slope and actually convert that to electrical energy through what are called magnetohydrodynamic generators. A big word, but very simply, it's just a gas-fired generator that produces electricity. And what this was intended to do then is feed these arrays. And Dr. Eastland actually took this idea to one of the largest oil and gas companies in the country, a company called Atlantic Richfield at the time. And Atlantic Richfield invested in Dr. Eastland's ideas and created a subsidiary called Arco Power Technologies, Inc. And they actually became the owners of 9 patents, several of which Dr. Eastland was the inventor or the lead inventor on. And what these patents developed was what eventually became the HARP project. In early 1990s, they began to fund this project after Dr. Eastland had demonstrated a number of possibilities. And, you know, what was interesting is it was almost like some of the ideas that were being kicked around for satellite-based technologies, or what was referred to as Star Wars during the Reagan-Bush administration, was now taking form as perhaps a ground-based Star Wars component or Star Wars-type system. And we began saying that. That was back when Clinton and Bush were running Clinton and Dole were running way back. And Ted Stevens, our senior senator from Alaska, had been talking about this project in the media, made a Washington Post story, and our local papers in Alaska started to get a little bit of attention. As we began to look into the project, we found many other possibilities that caused us a great deal of concern. We began a dialogue with Dr. Eastland that has continued even into these days. And you know what we know is the ideas that Dr. Eastland had, many of them were pretty interesting. You know, he had a concept within the patents, for instance, for replenishing ozone. You know, if ozone is really the problem everybody points to, it would seem like this concept would have been one that would have been well worth, you know, looking into. And to this day, no one has looked into it. The other was the idea of being able to use radio frequency energy for triggering other kind of chemical reactions in the upper atmosphere that would knock out specific pollutants. You know, and this is, again, something that the military has not yet pursued under the project. The other areas that were real interesting that Dr. Eastland came out with was one was earth-penetrating tomography. In plain language, it would be like X-raying the earth, but looking into the earth several kilometers deep for underground facilities, tunnels, and the like. In fact, that particular use back after the first Gulf War in the 90s became of great interest to our military, because we were looking for these so-called weapons of mass destruction that were supposed to be there. Unfortunately, you know, nothing really came of that, but yet you go back to those original Senate hearings and the discussions about the funding for HARP, and in 1995-96, the funding for HARP was actually under non-proliferation and counter-proliferation of nuclear weapons. And the idea was that this would be used for locating underground facilities in places like Iraq and other countries of concern to the United States. The problem is, when they started looking at that particular use, there were a lot of risk factors that had not been well considered. One of them came out by a researcher by the name of Brooks Agnew, who found that that actually what would happen is you could trigger perhaps other kinds of events by using essentially electromagnetic energy, in this case radio frequency energy, that might actually trigger geologic events. Even the idea was kicked around that it might even trigger earthquakes. You know, and there's actually Department of Defense Secretary William Cohen back in April of 1997, he was lecturing, interestingly enough, on weapons of mass destruction he was concerned about and was expressing concern about were, in fact, weapons that could trigger earthquakes or volcanic eruptions. And this is what he said on, and he said this April 28, 1997. This is Secretary of Defense William Cohen. He says, and I quote, "Others are engaging even in an eco-type of terrorism, whereby they can alter climate, set off earthquakes and volcanoes remotely through the use of electromagnetic waves," unquote. And that was in a DOD, Department of Defense news briefing just following that, his keynote address to the Conference on Terrorism and Weapons of Mass Destruction and U.S. Strategy. And that was at the University of Georgia when he said that. What is interesting about all of this is this type of technology. I mean, consider the United States government at that level discussing the fact that they believe terrorist states would possess this type of technology. In other words, it's simple enough for unsophisticated governments to develop. And this is, again, why it was of concern to us when we started to look at earth-penetrating tomography and the things that Brooks Agnew and others were saying about its possibilities in triggering exactly these kind of events. That became, you know, a great concern. One of the other things that that we looked at with the HARP system was an application that Dr. Easton pointed out, which was over-the-horizon radar, being able to look around the curvature of the Earth for incoming objects. And utilizing HARP, that is also one of the stated objectives that comes out in military planning documents. And there's nothing really wrong with that. I mean, the idea of looking over the horizon for incoming objects makes good sense. When you think about HARP specifically, you know, the idea that you can not only see things from very high elevations, like intercontinental ballistic missiles, but you can also see things coming in at very low elevations. So you can actually see those objects and be able to even discern which ones are carrying nuclear payloads with the HARP system. HARP is capable of being able to create enough energy to create a unique signature or field around each of those objects that with satellite-based detectors and other technologies that have been developed in conjunction with this system, you can actually determine which of those objects carry nuclear payloads. And of course, all of us can see the value of that, you know, in any time, you know, being able to distinguish which are the real threats and which are just not necessarily as severe threats. Again, looking at all of the technologies surrounding HARP, there is a basket of things that we'll talk about right after the break. When we come back, we'll get into the last of those objects and possibilities, and then we'll take calls at 800-313-9443. We'll be right back after this break.
And welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich. And we're on RBN Live, and we'll be on every Wednesday from 11 to 1 p.m. on Central Time. And I'm broadcasting actually from Alaska today, and this is my home just north of Anchorage. And we're talking today a little bit about HARP, which is a project that operates here in Alaska and has gotten quite a bit of attention over the years. And we were just before the break talking about a number of the applications, the uses of this system. And I want to remind people of the call-in number if people want to get in on the show today and ask some questions or add some comments. The phone number here is 800-313-9443. Again, it's 800-313-9443. And I'm Dr. Nick Begich. Yeah, the other issues that we didn't get into before the break, you know, we started talking a little bit about the over-the-horizon radar, the ability to determine what those incoming objects might be in terms of carrying nuclear payloads. One of the other possibilities with HARP is what's called EMP, electromagnetic pulse, or a surge of energy so strong that it overrides the electronics on those incoming craft, things like the radars, things like the flight controls, all of these things that the that can be disturbed electronically can be overridden by an EMP. And this again is a surge of energy. With HARP, it's huge. I mean, it covers an incredible area. With smaller systems, they've even developed small EMP systems that can be used by police departments as an example, to affect the electronic ignition of automobiles, to stop them from operating. In other words, instead of the fleeing felon syndrome of chasing people through the streets, being able to target specific vehicles and hit them with an EMP blast that knocks that electronic system, control system for the automobile out, causing it to stop. You know, there's a lot of ideas that come out of these military projects. Some of them are good and some not so good. And the next couple that we get into fall into that not so good category. And these are the ones that have caused perhaps the greatest amount of controversy around the world, and it's the idea of being able to use the system in a way that could affect weather. One of the concepts that was put out there by Dr. Eastland in the beginning was the idea that you could, in fact, heat the ionosphere. In fact, the military called the earlier versions of these kinds of systems ionospheric heaters, because they would heat up an area, this area above the Earth, and they would literally push that area a 30-mile diameter area, push it out so it looked like a column. So 30 miles in diameter, maybe 200 miles long of space. And what would happen is that space would get filled with the lower atmosphere coming in from down below, altering the pressure systems within the region, or, for instance, being used in a manner that could steer or move jet streams into much different locations. And in this way, control and manipulate weather patterns over huge geographic areas. The thing about that is it actually violates an international treaty that we and 60 other countries signed years and years ago. In fact, most people don't even know the treaty exists. And it was an environmental treaty designed to not use environmental weapons as weapons of war, whether it be to trigger earthquakes, volcanic eruptions, or tidal waves, or those kinds of things, the very kinds of things that William Cohen was talking about in that DOD news briefing. The last three Secretaries of Defense, interestingly enough, have all raised the question of whether or not this treaty ought to be abandoned based on the fact that new technologies have emerged that make these technologies possible. And, you know, and when you look at, you know, the history of weather modification, it's not something particularly new. It's been around for a long time. It's been used, but going back as far as even the Vietnam War and before, they used cloud seeding and different methods for creating control of rainfall. There's been interest in this since the 70s with projects like Rainmaker 1 and Rainmaker 2 operated out of White Sands, New Mexico. There have been a lot of attempts at changing the weather, but nothing as big and potentially impacting as what HAARP is. The issue of weather modification, in fact, was of such interest that the European Space Agency, after HAARP began to make the news, contracted with Dr. Eastland to look at using HAARP-type systems for knocking out tornadoes, as an example. And that peer-reviewed paper was eventually completed and delivered in Europe and was well accepted. And what it showed is, and if you think about this, it makes sense, I guess, from a science perspective. When you look at tornadoes and how they're formed, it's essentially a cold weather front running into a warm weather front, or vice versa. Where it creates that cold and heat relationship creates sort of a twisting action that forms that a tornado, because you've got currents going up and currents going down, and you get that kind of a spinning action. Well, the more heat differential between the two fronts, the greater the intensity potential of the tornado. So the idea was, if you could heat up that cold front using the microwave energy essentially coming off of this huge array of antenna, you would in fact eliminate the possibility or decrease the possibility of a tornado forming. And that was the basis of that particular paper. Well, it didn't stop there in terms of weather modification. That got the attention of our FEMA and NASA, and they actually contracted with Dr. Eastland to come up with a satellite-based technology using space-based lasers that might even do the same thing. We'll come back after the break, talk a little bit more about the weather modification applications, and we're RBN Live. And welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich. And you're on RBN Live with us today. and we'll be broadcasting this program every Wednesday from 11 a.m. till 1 p.m. Central Time. And we're glad to have everyone with us today. Today's topic is HARP. The call-in number, if you'd like to get involved in the show, is 800-313-9443. Again, 800-313-9443. Just before the break, we were talking about the possibilities of weather modification using the HARP system. And we were also talking about some of the follow-on work of Dr. Eastland in this area. You know, the idea of weather modification after NASA and FEMA looked at it, and he finishes work for them. Another project came up, and where he really started to look at the effects of weather modification. Eastland delivered a paper last October at the University of Pennsylvania on weather modification, where he had advanced his ideas significantly, where he believes now that you could actually modify weather using 1,600 times less energy than what he thought even a few years ago. And this is significant because now you're in the realm of today's possibilities rather than some remote future possibility of being able to use energy itself as the mediator or modulator of weather systems. And, you know, today where climate change, whether we agree with the causes being purported in the mainstream media or not, the reality of it's here, so the interest in manipulating weather systems is also here. The problems arrive quickly along with this. It's not unique to our country. Virtually every industrialized country of any significance in the world has looked at this issue. Advances have been made in the former Soviet Union and Russia. In fact, they've offered weather modification services commercially for years. Out of Russia. Chinese have looked at this technology as well. The problem comes in, whether it be private contractors or governments, is you can't confine weather changes to the boundaries of a sovereign country. And this is where the problem lies as well. Why the treaty going back to the mid-70s was originally enacted was for exactly that reason. Yet, within that treaty, it allowed for one sort of out language for each country, and it was domestic use. And this is true in most treaties. If you look at the chemical and biological treaties as an example that the former Soviet Union, Russia, and other have signed, those treaties forbid the use of certain chemicals and biological weapons on foreign adversaries, but they permit the use within the boundaries of a sovereign country. In other words, if you're remember back in 2000 when we had the situation in Moscow where a theater was overrun by Chechen rebels, and eventually the Russian authorities gassed everyone in the place with a specific type of gas that ended up killing not only a lot of terrorists but a lot of the hostages as well. Well, that particular gas would have and is in fact outlawed by the very treaty the Russians had signed in terms of the international community outside of their own boundaries, but was in fact permitted within their boundaries, and so you see the consequences of that. Well, all of these treaties are the same. In fact, in our country, those very chemical and biological weapons that are forbidden to be used against our adversaries, there is no prohibition within domestic law that parallels those treaties. And the same is true with virtually every treaty we sign. Weather modification was just another example of it. The foolishness of that is, you know, weather doesn't respect national boundaries or artificially drawn. They have nothing to do with the way in which air currents and weather forms and flows through the world. It's interesting to note that both houses of Congress in the last session had bills pending that would actually create oversight committees on weather modification on civilian and government uses. And this is important because these kinds of uses have not gotten wide play in the media, and yet our government seriously looking at how to control and regulate the uses of weather modification. And so we sit on, you know, we sit today with systems that very, very well could do this, that are being developed and used commercially, and yet the impact of that is not being factored in to any of the scenarios dealing with earth changes, weather changes, climate changes taking place around the globe today. When you go back to HARP again, other applications that come up and start to get a deep concern, and this has been registered by both the European Parliament and in resolutions they've passed opposing HARP, as well as the development of technologies that would influence the manipulation of human beings. And, you know, microwave energy, particularly this type of energy, was reviewed years ago, back in 1969. There was a book published called Unless Peace Comes, and in that book was a chapter on that was titled, interestingly enough, How to Wreck Your Environment. It was written by J.F. Gordon MacDonald, who was a geophysicist at UCLA and a science advisor to President Johnson when he was holding that position. And what essentially it said is that that we could, in fact, if we could ever figure out how to electronically stroke the ionosphere, this layer above the Earth beginning about 30 miles out, if we could ever figure out how to electronically stroke it, how to manipulate it, we could, in fact, return a signal to the Earth that would manipulate the behavior of people over huge geographic areas. Now, this was, this is Johnson's ideas and his idea. Because, as an advisor and as a scientist, were actually echoed in a publication a few years later, back in the early 70s, by Zbigniew Brzezinski called Between Two Ages. And within that, he quotes J.F. Gordon MacDonald and his ideas about manipulating the ionosphere. And what he said was that eventually, no matter who is in power, or liberal or conservative, the temptation to use this kind of technology to manipulate the behavior of people would be greater than the good sense to not engage in that kind of activity. I mean, think about it. The idea of governments being able to manipulate the emotional states of individuals, is this possible? There's a whole project built around this that has this integrated in it within the government. It's called Project Solo, and it's a Air Force-run program where you go into areas like Iraq before the battle begins, and you begin to broadcast propaganda, but you also use that platform. It's a space. It's a airborne platform in aircraft, heavily loaded with communications equipment, and it's used for creating the propaganda broadcast, but it's also used for piggybacking signals under Project Solo on the normal radio programs airing in the region. So, for instance, in the Middle East and Iraq, they were airing the normal Muslim music and prayers through their local stations. And we would embed a signal back in the first Gulf War that created anxiety and fear. Anyone listening to those broadcasts would begin to experience anxiety and fear without explanation. And what did we see happen? The fourth largest army in the world gave up like school kids on a fire drill, in terms of how that first war ran. And that was a pretty remarkable and telling example of what is possible. The Scottish media later reported on the use of that technology, which they considered and others considered to be the most effective in the conflict. But looking at HAARP as a system, going back to the topic of the day, these are a huge antenna array, one that could affect an entire hemisphere, a huge geographic area. This got the attention of the Russians, who have been involved in this kind of research in the past, and also got the attention of the European Parliament. The European Parliament, that's another interesting story. We'll maybe get into that story, how we ended up becoming involved with them and what they did on this issue. But, these governments, other governments of the world began to inquire and ask questions about HAARP. Some governments actually had a good deal of knowledge. A Strategic Studies Institute in London had been looking at Russian papers on this technology. One of the papers they pointed out for ionospheric heaters was the idea of being used for affecting comets or asteroids or space junk returning to Earth. Because think about this. If you could create a hole in the ionosphere that would push the lower atmosphere in, and instead of having 30 miles of atmosphere between the ionosphere and the Earth, maybe have this column that goes out a couple hundred miles of atmosphere. Now, why would that be important? Well, if you think about incoming comets or incoming asteroids, what happens is they encounter the atmosphere of the Earth, and they're coming in at very rapid speeds, very high velocities. When they hit that atmosphere, they create friction, and they actually burn up, most of them, before they ever hit the Earth. Only very large objects can actually make it through and actually impact the Earth. So the idea was that if you could stretch out, instead of 30 miles of atmosphere to break up those objects, maybe create 7 or 8 times that distance, you could break up much larger objects. Really, not a bad idea, and it came out of Russian research on their own ionospheric heaters. In fact, if you go back to the Russian research in this area, you got to go back to the 1970s and a thing that was called the Woodpecker signal. And those listening to us on shortwave and ham radio operators might remember this back in the 70s, where there was radio interference. It almost sounded like the sound of a woodpecker pecking on a tree. And this signal that ham operators triangulated and figured out were coming from five transmitters in the former Soviet Union. These were the very first ionospheric heaters of any size reported on the planet. And so when HARP started, HARP became a much different system because it was more versatile, more powerful. Eventually, the goal is to have an effective radiated power of 1 billion watts. You know, that's a huge amount of radio frequency energy in the effective radiated power ranges. And when you're looking at this, you know, it's an amount of energy that's coherent or rhythmic that can be manipulated. It's not like the background noise that the Earth creates or the static that's received from solar flare activity. Those are all random kind of natural events. When you start to use coherent energy, then you can create very different effects. And the root of a lot of this science gets into this concept of what's called resonance. Resonance is sort of the compounding of harmonic energies between people. So you can think about it in this way, by analogy. Back in World War I, this effect was noted when troops were marching across bridges through Europe, and you know, you'd have maybe several thousand troops marching in step, in rhythmic step, in harmony with one another across the bridge, and it would set up a rhythm that eventually, even hours after the men had crossed the bridge, that would collapse those bridges, and is based on resonance, which is a combination or a harmony between the signals. And you get the same kind of effect, in fact, if you're listening on radio on some of the FM stations and other stations that are broadcasting this program. What you'll pick up is when you have resonance between the transmitter and the receiver, you have harmony and you have a nice clear signal. Otherwise, you just get static between the lines. Now, the thing about coherent signals, the kinds of things that HARP can produce, are that they can then change the character of the ionosphere. The ionosphere is chaotic in many respects, but when you pump energy in a very specific way, the ionosphere begins to act rhythmically, in resonance, in harmony with the signal on the ground, actually becoming a part of that machine on the ground. And when it does that, it changes its character from DC, or direct current, to alternating current, and it acts like a big broadcast antenna in the sky, sending back this signal to the Earth that's used for Earth-penetrating tomography and can also be used for changing either accidentally or purposefully the emotional states of human beings. There was a special, actually, on that whole subject, and it was aired on CBC TV, Canadian Broadcasting. They're public broadcasting, similar to BBC in Great Britain or public television in the United States. But they had done a story on this whole issue of physical control of the mind. And in the course of it, this subject came up. And there were a number of scientists, including one Persinger from Laurentian University, that talked about this technology. And what he said was that what you could do, in fact, is create a signal that would be would create anxiety and tension in the population. And then, for instance, you could broadcast in the normal news broadcasts of the day some kind of indictment on some ethnic group or some country that we could blame for all of our ills. And what would happen as a natural course in the way human beings act is we would turn a lot of that anger and anxiety towards whatever we thought that cause might be. And when you think about that as a technique, could that happen in today's world? The answer is absolutely yes. And the problem is this, is there were two other individuals that were interviewed for that one CBC special, the Morrises, who were responsible back in the 80s for this whole concept of non-lethal weapons and some of these ideas being introduced to the first Reagan-Bush administrations. And what they found is that by manipulating energy, we could create these kind of effects over large areas. And the problem was the Russians had advanced it. A lot of the folks within the U.S. have not been able to really talk about these technologies, but in fact, they've developed over the years. People want to get a lot of information on that subject. go to the archives at RBN Live and take a look at last week's program where we got into some detail on this. You know, the thing about HARP, too, is as far as its size, you know, never before had we developed anything quite so big, and it's not the only system of its kind. There have been several transmitters now built across Canada. There's a system that's been built across Europe called the IZICAT system. The old Russian transmitters, I don't believe, are operational now, but there's not been much in terms of information coming out of those areas these days. So we don't really have that data. We know back in 1990 and 91, the Russians actually made overtures to cooperate in missile defense utilizing these phased array or ground-based antenna. And for missile defense applications, they may have some very good uses. Here's where all of the problem lies with this technology and many others, is certain uses, weather modification as an example, that could have profound effects on everyone, are not really discussed in the open where they ought to be discussed. The idea of manipulating human behavior is even more profound, because this violates, at least for me, some of the fundamental rules of engagement. You know, when you think about interference with what goes on in the minds of people, this is really interference with free will, something that even God doesn't do. I mean, this is a violation of the fundamentals of humanity. When you think about who we are and what we are, you know, our ability to speak freely, to assemble peaceably and freely, to associate freely, to have freedom of religion, all of those things first require freedom of thought. And that's what we're talking about and why this becomes important. Because when you look at the HARP system, it is the largest system of its kind in the world. And whether this is a side effect, as military planners continue to insist, or whether this is a deliberate effect, it's a real effect that can be created with this system. Even using the Earth-penetrating tomography application, the idea of looking into the Earth several kilometers deep, you can create that kind of effect. It's the same frequency ranges, the same broadcast signals that are used for that particular application are, in fact, the same that can affect us biologically. We're going to be back right after the break. I hear the music coming up, and we're on RBN Live, and this is Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich. And we're back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich, and you're listening to RBN Live, and we're broadcasting this program every Wednesday from 11 to 1 p.m. Central Time, and I'm broadcasting from just north of Anchorage, Alaska, and today's topic is the HARP issue. And those of you that are tuning in for the first time, we appreciate you being here. Let me give you the call-in number. It is 800-313-9443. We're going to be back also for the next hour on the same subject, so we'll be getting into a little bit more detail. I want to mention a couple of websites. I want to mention the research that we use in our current work is provided by virtue of the Lay Institute on Technologies, which can be looked at Lay, L-A-Y, Institute.org. There's a lot of information there. We're using that as a place to post our documents and archives, so you'll see a lot of good background material available on that site. The other website is a commercial site. It's where a lot of articles and postings, it's where a lot of my material is posted, as well as a lot of the products that Earth Pulse offers. That is at www.earthpulse, E-A-R-T-H-P-U-L-S-E, earthpulse.com. So for information, you can look at both those sites. And again, for a call-in number today, to get involved in the program, it's 800-313-9443. And just before the break, we were talking about HARP and some of its implications. You know, it's been an issue that's been around for a long time. You know, when we first got involved in this, it really was a short article we had read in our local paper. It really wasn't a lot of information. And then I read in a foreign publication a 5-inch article, just a little tiny article, about the system in Alaska. And quite frankly, what it had to say struck me as unbelievable. And unlike a lot of folks, I don't just leave it there. I went to the library, looked at the sources they were quoting to see if they were accurate. In fact, they were. And they led me to additional source material. Eventually, I wrote an article published in that same magazine, and that began really my work on this subject. It seemed like something that needed to be looked at. We needed more information. Even to this day, this project continues to advance. without the kind of independent oversight that it probably needs. And certainly, not just from my perspective as an investigator on the subject, but also from the perspective of now the European Parliament and others. In the next hour, I'll talk a little bit about how that happened. It's an interesting story. I mean, you know, how these things happen really demonstrated one thing for me, is that on this issue or in any other issue, what makes a difference is people getting involved. And it doesn't have to be this issue. You know, there's hundreds of issues out there. This is an election year, a year where accountability should be central to everyone's mind. You know, this project is just another example of a lack of accountability in government and a lack of open public debate. You know, the government has become increasingly opaque, difficult to look into. What we need is a transparent government, and we're getting the opposite. What has happened is personal privacy and liberty is being sacrificed for what we call national security. And what security is there without liberty? There isn't any. And the fact of the matter is we've seen an erosion of our liberties based upon an amplification of fear, and now we have technologies that can play on that. And that's why I think this is an important debate for the day. So, and welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich. And you're listening to RBN Live, and we're going to be with you every Wednesday from 11 a.m. till 1 p.m. Central Time. And we hope you pass the word on to others. And I want to give the call-in number again, 800-313-9443. Your calls are welcome today. Let's get involved in this program on HARP. There's probably a lot of things I'm missing. You know, over the years, we've covered so much on this topic that oftentimes we get on the radio and we forget some major points. So listeners, if you're out there and you've heard some things that you know others are probably going to be interested in, give us a call and let's get this issue out there. You know, HARP, when we started, was pretty obscure a topic, still is for a lot of people, but it has changed. You know, over the years, we've been able to get the issue out. The European Parliament, as I said, had actually taken action on this issue. And I want to tell a little bit about that story and how that happened, because just before the break, we were talking about the fact that individuals can do a lot, can make a big difference. And that's a really a prime example of it. In the early days, when we started on this issue, our thought was that we could take printed material, the written word, in that case, the book Angels Don't Play This Harp, put it out there in a compelling way. We used over 300 source documents that are quoted within the book, so it gave it a lot of credibility and a way for people to look at the issues, and those that had a science background or just an interest could pursue any aspect of those issues they wanted. And our thought was not to shape the debate, but make sure that there was a debate. And I think that's the important, you know, the important message in all of this. We don't always win our own arguments on technology or on any other issue, but the fact that we can at least have the argument and have it in a manner that leads to good public policy, that is the American way. That's what this Democratic Republic was based on. The issue of HARP for me became important because I realized the implications. And in getting involved in it, we began to go on radio and talk about the issue, and of course people hear us, pass it on to others, and you know, eventually we were able to get quite a bit into print, quite a bit out there in the open literature. And then what happened is listeners and readers began to act. And this is something everyone listening today can do. You know, become a committee of one, take on the issue that's important to you, or participate with those that are already taking on issues that are important to you. And what happened for us, people began to contact us asking, you know, what can we do? And the first thing we said is pass the information on to people that make policy, because that's where things change. And some people did that. In one instance, a gentleman in California heard us on the radio, sent his marked up copy of our book to a person that was involved in politics in Great Britain and in Europe. Tom Spencer was his name. And Tom, at the time, was a conservative from Great Britain who also was chairing the environmental subcommittee of the European Parliament. Now, that's kind of a mismatch when we think about environmentalism and conservative politics, but in Europe it's a very different situation, and it's dealt with differently, quite frankly. I mean, it's not a science political football. It's really about, you know, what makes good sense, and it's more about stewardship, I think, than anything else, the idea of being responsible for what happens around us. So Tom read the material. He, you know, took the same skeptical view that I had originally taken, and he went to his military folks in Great Britain, and what he got was interesting. Everywhere he went, they were aware of the program, but they said, stay away from it. And for Tom Spencer, by the grace of God, he decided that, no, you know, that's the invitation to get involved. You know, when people start telling someone with integrity to back off and not get involved, usually until the answers are answered and there's a good reason to do that, the opposite occurs. And that was the case with Tom. Right after the break, we'll get back to that story. And we're on RBN Live, and you're listening to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich. Welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich, and you're listening to RBN Live, and we're brought to you every Wednesday from 11 a.m. till 1 p.m., and we're going to be talking about new technologies and their impacts over the next few weeks, and we're going to be starting to bring in some guests, some people that I've met over on the road over the last 12 years dealing with technology issues. I think we'll have some interesting programs yet to air. And if you're interested in what we've done so far, we've dealt with energy issues and the impacts of climate change. That's an archived program. And also last week we dealt with this whole issue of physical control of the mind, which is an archived program. So take a look at those at the website for rbnlive.com. You know, today we're talking a little bit about, just before the break, about this, how we got the European Parliament involved. And it started with a caller in California contacting Tom Spencer, who I'd mentioned was chairing the Environmental Subcommittee of the European Parliament. What Tom did is he tracked me down, gave me a call, and we began to talk about that issue and started to discuss, you know, how can we really approach this? What kind of information can we get to policymakers there that might make a difference? And at our expense, we actually organized a trip. We went to Brussels to meet with Tom, as well as stopped in seven or other cities in Europe. And we were able to get media attention and began to put a network of NGOs, non-governmental organizations, as well as government representatives involved in the dialogue. And what we were able to do is, starting with Tom Spencer as a conservative, we were able to form, with the help of members of the European Parliament, a coalition of conservatives, social democrats, and Greens, which essentially is like, in the United States, would be the equivalent of the Republicans and Democrats actually getting somewhere on an issue that really mattered. And in this case, they came together on the issue, and we were able to, over four trips into Europe, be able to begin to build a relationship with parliamentarians, begin to lobby parliamentarians in a way that resulted eventually in a resolution. What happened in the interim, kind of in the middle of it, was a lot of discussion about technology's impacts on climate change, for instance, which, you know, is still a highly controversial and debated subject. The one thing I think most people agree is things are changing. The cause is still debated. But what happened is we were brought over to speak at a group called GLOBE, and this was, again, based in Brussels, and they brought me over to speak on Arctic issues. And GLOBE was composed of 200 nationally elected legislators from 44 governments. And so this included people from literally all around the world. And I had a 20-minute segment to present on HAARP and get this issue out. And Tom Spencer from the European Parliament facilitated this meeting because at the time he was the president of that particular organization. And the predecessor to him in terms of that position was Al Gore, and it was just before Al Gore was elected vice president. And Al Gore was a good friend of Tom's. They used to spend time in each other's homes when they travel. And Tom Spencer actually called Al Gore on the HAARP issue. I was in his office when he made the call. He made that call from his parliamentary office in Brussels. And after spending time with each other, communicating over the years, and even after his election into the vice presidency, It was the one set of calls that Al Gore never returned, supposedly concerned about the environment today, but he couldn't return a call on probably the most environmentally impacting weapon system ever contemplated. And I think that's an interesting thing, because Tom Spencer didn't get dissuaded. I mean, the State Department sent someone over to try and get him to shut up and not deal with the issue. Tom Spencer wouldn't do it, and he continued to press. And then we made our presentation to this group, Globe, and at the end of the presentation, an elderly woman approached me, and she introduced herself, and she said, "Hello, I'm Maria Beckett, and I represent the Orthodox Church in the First Patriarch in Istanbul." And then she said, "We trace our roots to the island of Patmos and the revelation of John, and what you've just delivered is the apocalypse." You know, and I was a little bit surprised to hear that. And I said, "Well, that's interesting." I said, "You know," and she said, "Well, we have a conference every year, and we'd really like if you would attend." And I said, "Well, send me the information, and, you know, I'll consider it." Well, the information eventually did come. About a month later, I got an invitation from Bartholomew I, who's from the Orthodox Church. For those who don't know, the Orthodox split from the Catholics back in 1054 A.D. when they couldn't agree on a number of issues. I guess that's not uncommon. But they formed the Orthodox Church. They were the first patriarch was next to the Pope before that split up. But he's considered the first among equals within the Orthodox faith. And, you know, what eventually happened is they asked me to attend this conference. It was a closed conference. It was to take place on the Black Sea on a ship. It included 400 scientists, political leaders from the region, parliamentarians from Europe, business people from throughout the region, and NGOs, non-governmental organizations involved in economic development, environmental issues. And actually the conference, interestingly enough, was called Religion, Science, and the Environment. What a strange mix. And it was interesting because we had on board Nobel Prize winning scientists and others, religious leaders from the region. We even had the Aga Khan, which is one of the few religious leaders recognized within the Muslim faith, on board. For those that don't know who the Aga Khan is, in the old days they used to put him on a scale, and once a year they'd come in and they'd fill the other side of the scale with jewels. And the Aga Khan today is a very small guy, very lightweight. They used to be these great big giant guys, and you can understand why. Well, anyway, this ship was like the think tank in terms of who was on board, and I'm looking through the agenda figuring, okay, they brought me all this way. Let's see where HARP is, and HARP was nowhere to be found. So I approached Maria, and I said, "What am I doing on this ship?" And the answer was, "Look, you have some people to meet here, and they need to meet you, and you've got some issues that need to be brought forward, and this is a good forum for you to meet some folks." Well, trapped on that ship with me was Tom Spencer and his wife, and that gave us 12 days to map out a strategy and really get into this issue to take it before the European Parliament. And so we set that strategy in motion, and we extended it to include not just HARP, but the whole configuration of what were being called at that time and are called today non-lethal weapons, weapons that interfere with our biological and mental processes in a way that is more devastating than even bullets and bombs. And so we talked about this, and we developed that strategy and agreed that that's the way we would approach it. And he would bring it through one of his subcommittees, which in the coming months was going to be dealing with the issue of security and disarmament. In fact, the committee, he'd, in the interim, become chairman of a new committee, and it was the Foreign Affairs Committee. So he became chairman of the most powerful committee in the European Parliament and had this on his agenda. And so he directed his subcommittee chair, the Committee on Foreign Affairs, Security and Defense Policy, the Subcommittee on Security and Disarmament, to hold a hearing February 5th, 1998, in the European Parliament. And that hearing was held. They flew myself in and three other experts on the opposition side of the technology, and they invited NATO to debate us on the military side of the technology. And what NATO did in that hearing, before the hearing actually, they said they wouldn't appear, they wouldn't participate because they had no policy on ionospheric modification, the stuff of HARP, nor did they have any policy on non-lethal weapons, and really didn't care to discuss it. So NATO refused to appear. What happened the night before the hearing is we were invited into a closed conference with the committee, the oversight chairman, Tom Spencer, two members of the European media, to get into the meat of the issue, and we spent 5 hours briefing them on the papers and documents that we had available. These were all non-classified public documents. We've never messed around with the classified materials. We really don't need to. And we demonstrated in that closed meeting an infrasound device, a device that could transfer a voice, just like people are hearing my voice today, directly through the skin into the brain in a way that was quite disturbing. And we demonstrated this because we wanted to enlarge the debate beyond HARP into this whole area of non-lethal technologies. What then happened the next day, we went into the hearing. The hearing was getting ready to open. We were supposed to have 15 minutes to make my case. I mean, 15 minutes, we scratched the surface. But that's what we were allocated, so we had to figure out a way to condense it. We did that. They then extended my testimony time to an hour and a half, just based on the questions. At the end of the session, we were able to prove the nature of the technologies. In fact, the science advisor to Santer, who was president of the European Union at the time, came up to me, and he said it was the most articulated discussion of weapons applications he'd ever heard, and he assured us that he would pursue it. And, in fact, the European Parliament did. It wasn't too much longer. In fact, one of the things we said, this is interesting, in that hearing, we said, you know, back in February of 1998, we said this was a precursor, this would eventually lead, and was one of the factors leading to the abandonment, what we felt would be the abandonment of the ABM treaty, the Anti-Ballistics Missile Treaty, between the former Soviet Union and the United States. This is something that was not in the mainstream media, or any other media for that matter at the time. The European Parliament was the only point in my presentation they took exception to and made it a part of the record that they did take exception to that. They could not fathom the United States abandoning that treaty without first cluing in particularly these committees of the European Parliament and our traditional allies. The reality was we said it would happen within a year, and that it would happen with the argument that there was no Soviet Union, therefore the treaty was invalid, was null and void, which is exactly the argument that the senior senator from Alaska, Ted Stevens, made on the floor of the Senate as a prelude to the eventual abandonment of that treaty. And, you know, what happened, it happened a little faster than we predicted. We thought it would be a year away, and it was 9 months. After the break, we'll get back to the final part of that story and talk a little bit more about HARP, and your calls are welcome at 800-313-9443. And welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich, and you're listening to RBN Live, and we're on every Wednesday from 11 a.m. till 1 p.m. And today's subject is the HARP issue, and we've been talking a little bit about some of the background, what got us involved, and how this issue has developed over the years. I was just talking before the break about the European Parliament, and there were a couple of points I failed to mention. One of them was the issue of how did NATO relate. You know, I mean, NATO didn't show up to testify in the hearing, but they sat in the back of the room, which we thought was kind of interesting. What we opened the hearing with, the document we opened with, bearing in mind NATO had said they had no policy on ionospheric modification, the stuff of HARP, and we opened up the hearing with a document that was a public document from NATO France called Ionospheric Modification for Weapons Applications. And the second document we opened with, again, the NATO saying they had no policy on non-lethal weapons, we opened with a paper from the Strategic Studies Institute in London, one of the most prestigious institutes reviewing military affairs in the world. And their paper was a discussion on the deployment of weapon systems, including the very systems that we were demonstrating, which were infrasound systems throughout NATO Europe, and NATO's insisting they had no policy guidelines, and in fact they didn't. You know, they had deployed all of this stuff all over Europe, and no clear guidelines on how to deploy it. Those guidelines were developed and released about 8 months after our hearing. The guidelines on ionospheric modification, we never heard whether they were released or not. Well, what happened after the hearing is the State Department sent in someone to try and discredit our work. They actually floated around the European Parliament 2 or 3 weeks, and they couldn't do it. What happened is every office they went to, because we had done our work, had a stack of questions, and the United States government provided absolutely no answers. At the end of the day, it was some months later. It was actually in January of 99 when this resolution took its form, and it passed as European Parliament Resolution on Environment, Security, and Foreign Policy number A4-0005/99. And this was passed January 28th, 1999. And this is what it says, and I'm going to read this because I think it's an important demonstration of what started as a phone call from a listener and ended up in a public policy statement in the European Parliament in a form of a very powerful and important resolution. And this is just part of a multi-page resolution, and this is what it says. Section 24 considers HARP, the High Frequency Active Auroral Research Project, by virtue of its far-reaching impact on the environment, to be a global concern and calls for its legal, ecological, and ethical implications to be examined by an international independent body before any further research and testing. Regrets the repeated refusal of the United States administration to send anyone in person to give evidence to the public hearing or any subsequent meeting held by its component committee into the environment and public risk connected with HARP, the HARP program currently being funded in Alaska. Section 25 requests the Scientific and Technical Options Assessment, STOA, panel to agree to examine the scientific and technical evidence provided in all existing research findings on HARP to assess the exact nature and degree of risk that HARP poses to both the local and global environment and to public health generally. Section 26 calls on commission to examine if there are environmental and public health implications of the HARP program for the Arctic Europe and to report back to the Parliament with its findings. And finally, and most importantly, calls for an international convention introducing a global ban on all developments, deployments of weapons which might enable any form of manipulation of human beings, unquote. Those were the sections that we were responsible for getting into the legislation, and by virtue of the fact that people paid attention to the issue and acted on what they knew to be right and true. And that started, again, with the very most important person in this equation, which was the guy who said, hey, I can maybe do something, and did it. And that's what I think is the message that underlying all of the work we've done over the years is first the recognition that we can really make a difference, and the second recognition that, you know, it's not just about us, it's about us as in everyone can make a difference. And it doesn't require a whole lot. You know, I use often as an example, the guy walking down the street and gives a smile to somebody walking the opposite direction. And it may have been something as simple as that little bit of human kindness that dissuades or convinces that person maybe not to go on with their plan for the day, which might have been to hurt themselves or kill themselves. You know, maybe that person then goes on and creates the next cure for cancer. And it started with a smile, changing a person's mind. The thing that we have to do is begin to act. And I think this is what many of us have failed to do in the past. We cite apathy as an excuse for not doing anything. We cite all of the reasons we can think of for not taking a step. And you know what faith is, as simply as it is for me, is not just knowing something in your heart, it's acting on it in this reality. You know, sitting around talking about these issues isn't enough. We have to take them on. And it may not be the issue we're covering today. Every single person in this listening audience has an issue that's important to them. And it's a matter of taking an action in furtherance of what you believe to be right and true. And I think that's our calling in life, is to try and recognize that that's what we're all about, to re-stimulate that creative component of each of us, what is underlying the human being. You know, it's about our intention and how we act on that intention matters. That's what free will is all about. And we're coming up on a break. Again, you're listening to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich. And welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich. You're listening to RBN Live. And we're on every Wednesday from 11 a.m. till 1 p.m. Central Time. So pass the word on and let others know that we're broadcasting here. And you can also call in if you have questions or comments today at 800-313-9443. We're going to be coming up, this is a long segment. After this, we're going to be in one short segment, and then we're done for the day. So if you've got calls, now's the time to start dialing in. The issue we were talking about right before the break, we were talking a little bit about sort of what happens in some of these things with HARP in particular. You know, it was a chance for people to really make a difference. So we continue to talk about the issue because it's not done yet. I mean, when you look at the technology and the way it's changing and the impacts of these technologies, what usually happens, things happen so rapidly. I mean, from the invention of the wheel to where we are today, technology will double again in 10 months. I mean, that's a phenomenal rate. And this is one issue pulled out of the, like a grain of sand on the beach of technology today, literally. I mean, it's just one example and one issue, and there are many, many issues. You know, we've tried to deal over the years with some of the bigger matters that we've run into. You know, we dealt with the cell phone issue in the book Earth Rising 2, along with the impact of underwater sonars, which are now making a little bit more media attention, both those issues. There's a major European study just released showing what we had asserted years ago, the idea of tumor formation and other problems associated with cell phones. You know, in fact, for a future show, we'll get into that issue along with the underwater sonars, what are being used by our Navy and others in the oceans now, jeopardizing the life in the seas. You know, it's almost prophetic. I mean, if you think about Revelations, you know, a third of the life in the seas dying, a third of the life on the land dying. You think of all those things and you go, wow, how close are we to that? And the reality is we're in the middle of it. And, you know, the fact of the matter is, you know, prophecy is about warning, and it seems like it's not at the hand of God, but really the hand of man, that we're creating the greatest challenges technologically and the greatest opportunities. You know, creativity is what I think is really what it's all about. I mean, when you think about being created in the image of the Creator, if you ascribe to that as I do, you know, the idea isn't about a person like me necessarily, and that's it. You know, the image is more than that. It's the creativity, the idea of being able to do things based on our own free will. We were just saying something about that before the break. You know, that's what makes us unique and different. And how we use our creative capacities matter a lot. You know, in the environment that has been created by our politicians and corporations today is really an environment of insecurity and fear. You know, it's about being afraid, almost in a constant state. And, you know, I have a background in physiology and health. I have a doctorate in complementary medicines. And, you know, when you look at brain activity of people that are experiencing fear and anxiety, what you see is those incoherent base background patterns. When you see people experiencing the emotions of love and compassion, empathy, the higher emotions of human beings, what you see are very rhythmic, coherent patterns, the kind of patterns that lend themselves to good thinking and full creative engagement. You know, the using of the capacity that God gave us, you know, as creative participators in what happens around us. And the fact of the matter is, everything that happens around us is up to us. And as individuals, we can make a difference. You know, that's what we've sort of forgotten as political leaders and others have tried to make us fit into some squishy collective. And that's not who we are as individuals. We're meant to express ourselves creatively and potently, each and every one of us, in the realm of influence that we occupy, which is right where we're standing. And recognizing that power and executing that power, I think, is what started me on this journey 12 years ago, and it was about the idea that, hey, you know, there's a real need for the translation of complicated science into plain language, and to be able to have a discussion about technology, and then be able to have enough knowledge to act on. And, what convinced me that it was so important was, you know, my dad was a member of the 92nd Congress, and as a congressman, I think back on all of the people I met and the people I knew as a kid growing up. And, you know, they're just average people, policymakers. You know, they only have the information they're given. And when their access to information is being limited to special interest groups, corporations of all kinds, and not to the average person with the concerns that we have, much less the technical areas that might impact us. Very few in the Congress have scientific backgrounds. And so the need for translation so that congressional leaders and other policymakers can ask the right questions is a critical element. You know, I was being interviewed by a reporter recently who said to me, you know, he's asking questions, very intelligent questions, and they presuppose a certain body of knowledge. And I said, you know, that's been the problem, is to ask the right questions, you have to possess a certain body of knowledge. And that translation of science to plain language you know, doesn't happen very often. In fact, the further you get away from the root of the science, the more difficult it is to understand. It's why you've got now specialists upon specialists upon specialists that can't communicate with each other, and there's not this sort of integrated approach to science that looks at how all these fields might interact, and there's a more lively discussion about it. In fact, most of the money we spend in the United States on science is spent by the military in what are called compartmentalized programs. These are programs where the sciences are deliberately separated out, making them very expensive and very inefficient because you don't see all of the implications of one branch of science against the other. In fact, as an example, the first scientific paper in any committee I'd ever delivered was a contrast of how Westerners, how we pursue our military science, and how Eastern Europe was pursuing theirs. And I delivered that paper back in 1978. And, you know, what it was about was saying, you know, the Eastern Bloc were using integrated approaches. They took all the disciplines, packed them together to come up with their scientific concepts, in some cases way beyond ours, and in other cases maybe not so advanced. But here's the point. The integration of science in the Soviet Union, in a country and in Eastern Europe that was economically way behind us in terms of productivity, they were able to keep up and represent a real threat technologically because of the method in which they approach their science. The Chinese approach that science the same way today, except with a whole lot more money involved. You know, the military research in these areas, including HARP, there are transmitters being built in China to produce the same kinds of impacts. And when you look at the Senate Intelligence Committee reports on China, which in China takes a long view, they don't take a corporate quarter-to-quarter view like our government and like our corporations do. They take a 40-year view and integrate a plan to get there. You know, capitalism in China isn't about finding a way to become more like us. It's finding a way to build their machinery of production to the point where they really can not only compete with us, but crush us with our own system. Their ideology hasn't changed, and yet when you look at what's happened, we've produced the biggest economic engine, three times the growth of the U.S., not since the Industrial Revolution of the 1880s have we seen this kind of industrial growth. Chinese military spending is approximately $65 billion, according to our Central Intelligence Agency. It's about one-ninth of what we spend in the U.S. We spend about $551 billion, according to next year's budget. But when you look at those numbers and you compare their relative productivity, what you get in China for $65 billion is probably more than you get in the United States for $550 billion. In other words, it's the productivity that matters, not the dollars spent. And when you look at Chinese productivity at cheap rates for building equipment that here we pay $2,600 for a hammer or a toilet seat for $1,500 under a military contract in China, they spend the next 15 cents on the bullet behind your ear because it doesn't happen there. You know, when you think about their production plants today, what took us in World War II to convert would take us months. You can literally convert by inserting a new computer program to tell the system what board to punch out. Instead of putting out video games, you're putting out missile guidance systems. We transferred enough technology for mechanized production in China to be a significant concern to everyone in the Western world, because not because capitalism's bad, because it's not about that. It's about what's being done, the collection of U.S. dollars based on trade deficits. I mean, they could crush us by just spending their money, you know, in terms of what they've built up in trade surplus. It's the same with the Middle East. If they just spent their dollars, they would crush this economy. That's part of the lever that's being put over us. You know, we're in a trap that we need to recognize and figure out a way out of, because ideologically we're not on the same page at this point in time with the Chinese. And the thing about technology as it changes, we're talking about weapon systems that no longer travel at thousands of miles an hour, like intercontinental ballistic missiles. We're talking about weapon systems based on energy itself, which travel at the speed of light, 186,300 miles per second. That's more than seven times around the world in less than a second. You know, tremendous velocity. So think about these technologies being advanced. Think about the fact that we've introduced under this administration a new concept for warfare. warfare. That concept is called preemptive warfare. It's where we decide who's our ideological or other enemy, and then we declare war on them, and we don't announce it. We just do it. We preempt them. Now, that might work when you got to move troops and ships and men and machinery around the planet, and it takes a few days to accomplish that. But what about things that take a second, like a blast from a high-powered laser or a particle beam weapon or any of these technologies that are being developed or a blast from a massive HARP-type system? These are the concerns that that many are beginning to express internationally, because it's not just about foreign adversaries. It's about who's really deciding what the ideologies of our country and others are. You know, I mean, look at the United States. You know, who decides what's right for the United States? It's more about moneyed interest, corporate interest, oil interests. I mean, why are we in Iraq now? Is it about democracy like we keep hearing on the radio and like we keep hearing on the TV news broadcast? I don't think so. It's about oil, and I think most people recognize that today. When you look at these issues that get us into conflicts, what happened in Afghanistan is an entirely different matter. But the fact of the matter is we're still there. And the reality is, you know, we spend 10 weeks training our guys, 18-year-olds, to go over there and police their countries, and we've been there now 3 years, and we can't teach them to police their own. I think it's time to go, and if it means they have a revolution, they're entitled to one. You know, it's called self-determination. It's what everyone's entitled to within their own cultural context. And what are we doing there? I mean, if they don't want democracy, let them have whatever they get. I mean, it's what they want. It's their revolution, not ours. They've damaged us enough. It's time to recognize what this is really about and really start to look at the alternatives. We're going to spend $1 trillion on this war and its cleanup. You know, $1 trillion is enough to make this country independent, significantly more independent than we've ever been of foreign oil, where we wouldn't have to be in the conflicts in the first place. We need to reassess, you know, what's driving national policy, make sure that it really is those principles of a democratic republic, those values that each of us hold. But what we see is an environment of fear and paranoia, the kind that, you know, it just doesn't lend itself to good thinking. And what we need is a transparent government. I mean, we don't need to know the national secrets in terms of how to build this stuff, but we ought to have the opportunity to discuss its consequences. And the military has their role, and it's an important role, and we need to make sure that role is used carefully and with great discretion, because these are our sons and daughters dying in combat, not someone else's. And we need to make sure, for whatever causes that we're truly engaged, that they're the causes that represent the values of the country. And, you know, each conflict generates its own, you know, its own element of support and detraction. But there comes a point, you know, where you capture the flag and the national leader where the war ends. And we've done all that. And we've been around long enough to help them out. They've got more oil than Carter's got peanuts, and, you know, they can take care of themselves if they choose to. And, you know, there's plenty of ways to leave a country after a war is over, and, you know, we've got our own infrastructure to rebuild in this country. We've got problems in the southeast. We've got another storm season coming upon us, whereas it'll prepare as you were the first time around. You know, there are other things that this country's resources need to be plugged into. You know, we're being told now to, you know, don't worry about your pensions, you know. You're on your own, basically, is what we're really being told. The government is saying they probably can't underwrite the losses that corporations are now going to sustain because they're reneging on their agreements to their employees over decades. You know, these are all things that are affecting us right now. You know, the whole Medicaid, Medicare fiasco and the whole changeover of that system, the threats to Social Security, things that are going to affect the average person here are being ignored, and we're all, again, being hyped up for the election season on issues that are issues of ethics and values that have nothing to do with our day-to-day lives. And unfortunately, you know, once again, I think the parties, the mainstream parties, have missed the point. People want accountability in government. That's what this program is all about. It's about accountability in terms of technology, which goes beyond government. It gets into the whole issue of the corporate world as well. You know, we need a balancing act to make sure, as things are advancing as rapidly as they are, that they line up with American values, those that we share in common, regardless of our political persuasion or our argument over the social issues that concern each and every one of us profoundly. But let's look at those economic issues and issues of accountability this year and not get sold the sidestep by politicians by getting us heated up over those issues that are continue to be debated, continue to be litigated, and eventually, you know, each of those issues gets resolved. But those issues that affect every one of us today, we're being traded off by both of the mainstream parties. HARP should have been investigated by our Congress and opened to public hearings years ago. Why is it that the European Parliament and others can achieve openness on a program that we're paying for, and we get absolutely no transparency on it? And it's fundamentally wrong. You know, these are programs that we should have an opportunity to discuss. These are technologies that have profound implications. If, in fact, some of the ideas of Eastland are correct, the idea of knocking out specific pollutants in the upper atmosphere, you know, that solves a huge problem, you know? I mean, the idea of replenishing ozone, if that's truly the problem that we're being told it is, this is a big deal. This is an important set of possibilities that ought to be looked at, and they're being ignored. Military's goal is to defend the country, to guard against every possibility. In other words, it's kind of paranoid thinking institutionalized, which is important. I don't want to downplay that. But at the same time, government is not about that, nor is it a risk-taking venture of the business community. It is about preserving the State of the Union. It's about a democratic republic where the most of the budget, most of the freedom, most of the decisions are at the local level, and that's not what we have anymore. And the international policy no longer represents what it represented 200 years ago. And we're headed to a break, and you're listening to RBN Live. And welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich, and you're listening to RBN Live. And we are into our last segment. Apparently there's been some trouble with callers being able to get through the last couple hours. We have a caller that came in the back door, I guess. Is he still standing by?
Yes, sir, I am.
All right. You had a question or a comment.
Doc, you're right on point. It took me 5 hours to find this phone number in my archive list. This is the international inbound phone line. But I wanted to compliment you on what you had to say and the fact that technology and the standstill of technology happening a little over 100 years ago. I've just this morning learned that there were hundreds of thousands of documents that Nikola Tesla had, which I knew there were a lot, but I didn't know there were several truckloads of them that were smuggled off by the U.S. government into hiding.
Right. That was right after his death. Yes,
yes, indeed. Sir. And I've enjoyed your the last 2 hours of your input and your comments. And I know there's a lot of callers out there that would love to have called in and had some questions to ask you. And there's just so much, and we don't have enough time right now. But I would appreciate it if you could, when you come back next week, is to start all over. I would like to know more about this meeting that you went on the ship. And why all this technology is being suppressed and what we can do to get some of it out.
Well, I appreciate that, and I'll tell you what, we'll make sure we allow lots of time the next program, and we won't jam up the agenda, so we'll keep it open and maybe get back into some of these same topics, because it is important. And you know, the whole story is kind of interesting, you know, always being on the other end of a talk show, being the guest, you don't really get to direct all the things that get said, so we're in a little different position this time, so it's kind of nice to be able to try to put it together in a way that gives a little different perspective, because, you know, that whole experience on the ship was an incredible experience, you know, where you meet some people that actually can make a difference. Some of them are, you know, a little more interesting than others. Some of them I didn't care for at all, but the fact of the matter is it was really a unique experience, kind of being on the outside looking in and being on the inside this time looking in.
Well, as an electronic engineer, I've been there, and I've been beating my head against the wall with 99.5% of all the electronic engineers that I come up with against, because the idea is, if it wasn't invented on their desk, it's not possible.
Yeah, well, you know, this is what I was saying about over-specialization. You know, what has happened is if it isn't in, you know, in right in front of someone, and no one, believe me, knows everything. You know, the problem is people just can't communicate. And a lot of engineers I've met over the years, they can parrot all the formulas, they know all, they've memorized everything, but they couldn't tell you the why or the how of any of it.
So
and that's...
It's funny to me because they don't think outside the box. They got their little sandbox and they got their little granular sand area, and that's all they want to play with, even though their theories are sound and fine and perfect. They can't think outside the box to find another reality. Hey, wait a minute, this really does work.
Yeah, you know, that's happened in all the sciences, and it follows what I call the 50-year rule. It's when everyone dies and their doctoral dissertations don't matter.
Right on. I want to let you go, but I want to let the listeners out there know that to write their questions down, because this has been one fantastic 2 hours. I just thoroughly enjoyed it, and I pray that you will come back with this subject again.
Well, thanks so much for being with us, and I hear
this
the...
Drew in Arkansas, by the way.
All right, Drew. Thanks, buddy.
Thank you,
and the music's coming up. We're at the end of the show. Good thanks for being with me, and check in with us next week.
God bless.
Being live, and it's changing the way we see Dr. Nick Begich.